atrium with its static mobile of dark cloud-like shapes, suspended over spiky metal mountains. The senator's secretary announced her, and she was ushered in almost immediately. He was older than the pictures on his webpage suggested, and without the careful lighting and photoshopping, he looked haggard. The smile he gave her was weary and a little sad. "Miss Quinn," he said, rising and extending his hand, "you have no idea how sorry I was to hear about your father's passing. I sent flowers to the funeral, but my schedule..." "They were much appreciated, Senator. Thank you," said Jennifer, who had not known about the flowers. "So what can I do for you?" "I can arrange a tour of the building, including a trip on our rather exclusive little monorail, if you like. But maybe you're a bit old for that now. It's been, what, 10 years since I saw you last?"
"About that."
"Edward doted on you. You must feel his loss very deeply." Jennifer nodded and smiled, but she was keeping a tight rein on her feelings so that she could watch him. "I was wondering if you could tell me something about your business dealings," she said, sitting as he did.
"With Edward?"
"Or with the Maynard Consortium generally." She said it lightly, as if the distinction didn't matter, but she saw the caution in his face immediately.
"I'm not sure I've had any direct dealings with Maynard," he said.
She smiled at his use of direct. Of course he hadn't. Maynard was all about indirection, money passing through multiple hands before it reached its destination.
"Was there a specific transaction you were interested in?"
He was testing the water, she thought, trying to find out how much she knew.
"Well, on November the 4th of last year, a political action committee supporting you received a contribution of $40,000 from a Nate Hapsel."
Powers performed a memory search and smiled.
"Ah, yes. Nate is a rancher in my home state," he said. "Very successful, and committed to staying so. You understand, of course, that my re-election committee had nothing to do with any PAC supporting me. That would be illegal. I believe Nate had concerns about federal encroachment into private lands."
"No doubt," Jennifer interrupted. "But the money wasn't really his, was it?
It came via an account in Singapore, through his hands, but the transaction originated with Maynard." "Oh, I think it's very hard to say what dollars belong to whom, once they come out of someone's bank," said Powers, smiling his politician's smile. "It was still Mr. Hapsel's money, however he came by it. Do you mind my asking what this is all about?
We have inquiries set up to look into campaign finance, and I've been cleared at every level. I hope you aren't suggesting anything untoward."
"Not at all," said Jennifer, matching his smile. "I'm really just trying to fill in some details about my father's interests, for personal reasons."
"Quite," said the senator, nodding thoughtfully.
"When did you last speak to him?" Jennifer asked.
"Oh, a month or so before he passed. He seemed in good spirits. A real tragedy and a shock to hear."
"What did you talk about?"
"Oh, this and that. The implications of a trade deal, I think. I really don't remember very well."
"So it wasn't specifically a sweep project?"
Again, her approach was light, conversational. But the senator was not as good a liar as Chevalier Latrange. He blanched, and his eyes flashed to the door, in case someone might overhear. When he spoke, his voice was low and hoarse.
"I'm not familiar with that, entity."
"Yes, Senator, you are," said Jennifer, "and I have the files to prove it." He stared at her, and his fingers began to drum on the edge of his desk.
"What do you want?" he said at last.
"Information," she said.
"About sweep?"
"Out of the question."
"Senator, I'm not looking to make life difficult for you, but I think my father had become involved in something he wanted to step away from. Something involving investments of which he did not approve. I need to find out what. I owe him that much. I suspect you do, too."
"Me?"
"Those contributions to your election campaign began a long time ago. As we were saying, There are laws against foreign campaign contributions, and there are ways around those laws. Your first successful run depended on them, if I'm not mistaken. My father was part of the decision to support you. I have proof of that. Powers sagged visibly, and the hand he raised to his face was momentarily unsteady. He shut his eyes and massaged his brow for a second, and the weary, haggard aura she had first noticed seemed to intensify. "All right," he said, "but not here. Meet me," he checked his watch, "at 10:30 this evening, on the steps of the Jefferson Memorial. It'll be quiet then. We can walk somewhere from there." She ate in what called itself a pub, surrounded by young people in suits who, she supposed, had government jobs. They had the brash confidence of people sure of their futures. Jennifer had taken the quietest corner she could find and spoke to no one. She was pretty sure she had not been followed. And while the mall surely deployed all kinds of covert surveillance, she saw no sign of anyone paying particular attention to her. Powers was right. Once the sun set, the crowds on the National Mall thinned to a trickle, and the Jefferson Memorial, set back as it was away from the other monuments, was almost deserted. The Jefferson Memorial sat atop a series of broad steps, looking across the tidal basin to the Washington Monument and, distantly visible through the trees, the White House, all lit up with a blue-white light that made it seem spectral and unearthly. The memorial itself was eerily quiet, apart from a lone policeman in shorts and on a bicycle, but wearing a sidearm, who gave her a respectful nod as she gazed up through the imposing pillars to the statue of the man himself. But the bronze figure was less compelling than the words inscribed on the walls. One panel, less familiar to her than the others, particularly stood out. It read, "I am not an advocate for frequent changes in laws and constitutions, but laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. As that becomes more developed, more enlightened, as new discoveries are made, new truths discovered, and manners and opinions change, with the change of circumstances, institutions must advance also to keep pace with the times. We might as well require a man to wear still the coat which fitted him when a boy as civilized society to remain ever under the regimen of their barbarous ancestors." She read it twice, lingering over the penultimate sentence, and marveling at the foresightedness and humility that could devise laws designed to change as civilization evolved. Coupled with the other panel's words on freedom and equality, it made a powerful statement, so that the statue of the man himself seemed to her almost an afterthought. This was a monument to an idea, something the likes of which she could not recall in England, for all its ancient palaces and monuments. Powers arrived 7 minutes late. He seemed tired and distracted, and instead of leading her away to some quiet late-night cafe or discreet bench, he eased himself slowly onto the hard steps on the side of the monument itself, and breathed out a long, slow sigh. "Well, Miss Quinn, you have disrupted my day." He said it without malice, looking from her to the vista across the waters of the Potomac, which glittered black under the lights of the mall. "I'm sorry," said Jennifer. "No, you're not," he said, "nor should you be." "Beautiful, isn't it?" he said, taking in the monuments around him, the broad, sparsely trafficked walkway, and the vista of muted splendor. "It deserves better. We all do." "Is that the conclusion my father came to?" "I don't know. Perhaps. So, what do you know, Miss Quinn, about unidentified aerial phenomena?" Jennifer gave him a baffled look. "What?" "I'm talking about UFOs." The bafflement lasted only a moment, and with it came a fragmentary memory too dark to see. something about being a child in her father's study. It wouldn't come into the light, and she was suddenly angry.
"Seriously?" she said. "This is what you thought would fob off on me? I've been killing hours waiting for you, and you give me little green men in flying saucers? What happened to, we all deserve better? Come on, Senator, you can do better than that."
I didn't say anything about little green men or flying saucers.
"Aliens, then, whatever."
"Not them, either."
"Can you just tell me what you are saying, so that we can get this sham over?"
"There's not so much I can tell you."
"Figures,"
snapped Jennifer, who was already resigned to her trip being wasted.
"You don't understand," he said,
and now he turned to look at her, and his eyes were alive with a young man's fire.
"This isn't about money, or not merely. It's about things I am forbidden to discuss."
"Forbidden? By whom?"
"By my allegiance to the American people, and the oaths I swore to serve them."
"Which means what exactly?
Do you understand the concept of black budgets?"
Jennifer felt like they had been driving along a straight road, when the car had swung off onto a track she hadn't known was there, traveling in a completely different direction.
"You mean?" "I mean taxpayer money, earmarked for projects so secret they cannot be publicly discussed. While all budgets are subjected to congressional oversight, there are special provisos for sensitive military projects. Title 10, Section 119 of the U.S. Code states, and yes, I can quote it from memory, "The Secretary of Defense may waive any requirement under subsection A, B, or C that certain information be included in a report under that subsection, if the Secretary determines that inclusion of that information in the report would adversely affect the national security. Any such waiver shall be made on a case-by-case basis." And that, Miss Quinn, is the Pentagon's get-out-of-jail-free card, though it is not, believe me, free in any sense for the rest of us. "Why is this relevant?"
"The Maynard money wasn't government money. It was private funding, originating outside the United States."
"Exactly so."
"I don't understand." "When projects are black, they cannot be discussed in any public forum. They can slip through the cracks of all government monitoring. Sometimes public interest has to rely on private funding."
"Maynard was paying you to give them classified information?"
"Absolutely not," said the senator, and his tone was, for the first time, loaded with self-righteousness. "I am no traitor, Miss Quinn. I am a loyal patriot determined to serve my country, its people, and its laws."
"So what did they get for their money?"
The senator hesitated, and the hauteur faded.
"A line of communication, not from me or my office," he added quickly, recovering a little of his defiance.
"From whom and about what?"
"The rancher I mentioned before, Nate Hapsell, owns a great deal of land, some of it very close to facilities in my senatorial district, which utilize those classified budgets we were just discussing. The money I received enabled me to have parts of Hapsell's land included in an environmental survey that identified a number of endangered species native to the area. Some fish, the Ash Meadow speckled dace and the charmingly named Devil's Hole pupfish, along with the southwestern willow flycatcher, and for good measure, that old favorite, the gray wolf.
None of which are actually there.
I can't say that for sure. But their appearance on the endangered species record means that the Hapsell land is effectively protected wilderness, a no-go zone for everyone, including the government. Anyone, including the Army, needs a permit to go onto those lands, and the screening process is set up to flag my office.
So what is really going on there?
Powers smiled ruefully. Just a little private monitoring of public expenditure, all quite legal. A little interdepartmental monitoring is good for the body politic.
Jennifer gave him a long appraising look.
You think this is about rival government agencies? She said.
I shouldn't be talking about it, he said. But I only agreed to meet with you,
because I had a lot of respect for your old man. But I'll tell you what any person with half a brain would tell you after looking at a map of Hapsel's land in Nevada. The government owns a lot of territory down there. For years they denied it, but they eventually came clean. Area 51, Miss Quinn. A flight development and test center run, I suspect, by the CIA. Possibly partnered with the Air Force, the NSA, and DARPA. And God knows what other alphabet soup government organizations. SWEEP is just another, a government watchdog, if you like, designed to keep black budgets in check. No, said Jennifer, it's not, and I can prove it. It's a network of private interests, and if I was in your shoes, I'd be wanting to know why the people in charge of those interests feel the need to be so close to a top-secret government installation. You've been manipulated, Senator, and not by private U.S. citizens. For the first time since they had begun speaking, he looked genuinely unsettled. SWEEP has never requested anything that would bend even the most liberal definition of propriety, he said. I'm sure this is all a simple misunderstanding. If it's not, Senator, you have a serious problem, said Jennifer. We all do. 36. Tamika, Pottsville, Pennsylvania. She wrote it all down, the fragment of peculiar metal. The story of a 9-year-old girl whose father was called to Roswell to investigate a crash site. A government program to protect and silence the girl and others like her. The children of Operation Paperclip scientists. All of it. She sat in her car in the parking lot of a 24-hour Dunkin' Donuts, working by the thin blue light of her laptop screen, driven by a fierce need to share all she had discovered. It would be a story unlike anything ever posted on Debunction, not an expose of hoaxes and the stupidity of conspiracy theorists, relayed in teeth-rattling sarcasm, but something quite different, something with weight and seriousness, and a genuine, if uncertain, curiosity. The site was all about exposing false truths, but that only meant it stood for the genuine truth, she told herself, as she formatted the document and hit post. This was no different, even though it might involve a degree of retraction of earlier stories, and that would certainly come as something of a surprise to their readership. It was after 2 a.m. by the time she finished. As the adrenaline faded, she found she was very tired. Sleeping in the car was not an appealing prospect. Driving around looking for somewhere safe to stay, risking getting pulled over for a DWB, or worse, was even less attractive. Suddenly, and for the first time since she'd left the city, she wanted to be back in her own apartment, in her own bed. Maybe it was time to go there. Maybe her post would blow the lid off whatever the guys who had come after her wanted to keep quiet. Maybe now the game was up for them. Maybe this was where she got on the highway to normality. There was one thing to do first. She finished reading Jersey's journal, turning the pages with feverish curiosity and mounting amazement. A week ago, she would have laughed it all off. But now? She stared at the final page in baffled excitement, and then, with the distinct air of violation, tore the page out. Bending the book cover as far as it would go, she located the slit in the fabric and the hard shape beneath it. A key. Small and brass. She wrapped it up in the page she had torn out and tucked it into her bra, replacing the book in the lining of her swanky new coat. She remembered that she had turned off her phone before going back to the Hollows and switched it back on. There were 3 texts from Audrey. Site hacked totes, said the first one. Office ransacked. She caught her breath and read the second one. Dion called. Your apartment raided last night. He's fine, but you must not go home. He's leaving town. Won't say where. Her hands were unsteady now. She scrolled to the bottom to see the third text. Don't call. Don't post to the site. They are watching. Marvin missing.
Tamika stared at the glowing phone. Somewhere in the distance, a police siren wailed. Marvin missing. This was on her. If anything had happened to him because of her. She waited only long enough to pull up the debunction site. Her story, which should have been front and center on the home page, was nowhere to be seen. In its place was a crappy photoshopped image of a flying saucer that looked like a lampshade. The headline read, "Roswell's Aliens Found." She stared, momentarily captivated, trying to decide if the story was supposed to be funny. But the more she read, the more straight-faced it seemed. The words popped off the screen. UFO, alien autopsy, government cover-up. It was all presented as serious and was all ludicrously fake, without even the self-awareness to be a good hoax. Beneath it was a story from yesterday, demonstrating how crop circles could only be created by a complex pattern of lasers from 1,000 feet above the ground, and another terrible picture of what looked like a plastic dinosaur model emerging from a pool of water and captioned, "Hard evidence for Nessie at last."
What the hell?
The comment section was full of mocking outrage from their regular subscribers. What had happened to debunction's snarky objectivity? How could they go from taking crappy conspiracy theories to pieces to endorsing it all without so much as an announcement? One commenting troll, even as he vowed never to visit the site again, charged them with pandering to the basest instincts of the internet for advertising dollars. Saddest of all, were the commentators praising them for abandoning their former skepticism and embracing the truth of unexplained phenomena. Tamika stared, speechless, tears welling in her eyes. Her life's work had been dismantled and made a mockery of. Just like that. She took a long, shuddering breath, wiped her eyes, and gripped the steering wheel. "Okay," she said aloud. "Okay. Don't post to the site." She had. Could that have given them a lock on her position? She'd been using the Dunkin' Donuts Wi-Fi signal, logged in as herself. Stupid. She thought the siren was getting closer. She snapped the ignition key twice, listening to the groan of the engine.
"Come on," she muttered.
She tried a third time, and the car rumbled into reluctant life. It lurched out of the parking lot, settling into its familiar rhythms as it warmed up. She was cruising comfortably by the time she turned onto Route 209 and headed southwest toward Tremont. Her plans were unclear. Hell, she thought, they weren't plans at all. They were instincts. Panicky, irrational, and uncertain. She looked at the road map from her glove compartment. She would take Interstate 81 southbound, to where it joined 78, then head west to Harrisburg. That would give her time to think, to make some decisions. She could stay on the interstate all the way to Roanoke or Knoxville, or maybe drop further south and make for Atlanta and her cousin Tanya, praying that the Corolla lasted that long. Then what? New Mexico? To sniff around for clues to one of the world's most familiar mysteries? Not that she had ever thought it was a mystery. Roswell was the UFO conspiracy theorist's Shangri-La. But all the official evidence said it was merely the site of a high-tech balloon crash. And she had never seen anything to make her think otherwise. It was all nonsense, and had in fact been central to what had driven debunction from the start. Now this, an old woman, and a twisted fragment of strange metal. It proved nothing. Tamika would keep looking. She was, as ever, a skeptic. But people were looking for her, trashing her office, destroying everything she'd built, discrediting her, painting her as a fraud and a crank, and endangering the people who worked with her. Maybe worse. Every car behind her might be a cop, or worse. There was a car a couple of 100 yards back that had been there since she left Pottsville. She could see nothing but headlights, so she had no idea if the car was marked in some way, or even what color it was. But it lingered in her rearview mirror, like a threat. She tried accelerating, and then slowing down again, just to see what the other driver would do. But the car maintained its distance, and with each half mile, Tamika's unease mounted. Before reaching Tremont, she turned left towards the interstate on a secondary road shaded by forest, and signposted to Echo Valley. There were no street lights, and she had to stay focused on the road ahead, but she was pretty sure the car behind had not followed her. Unless the driver turned off its headlamps, that would be bad. She swallowed and concentrated on driving. The road was narrow, lined by trees with pale bark that flashed in the glare of her high beams. At this time of night, the road was utterly empty. She wouldn't be able to evade drones or helicopters, but there was no point worrying about such things. Somehow, she doubted the men who'd come after her in New York had that kind of organizational reach. If they came for her, it would be a couple of guys in a car with a shotgun in the trunk, their headlights turned off, so they could get nice and close before running her off the road and into the woods, not as a drone, operated out of some Nevada control center. The thought didn't make her feel better. The country road had been a mistake. It wasn't going to save her time, and it was doing nothing for her nerves. The darkness was absolute, the forest on either side of the road impenetrable. And it occurred to her that if the Corolla died on her, this might not be the best place to be a single black female. And there might be bears in the woods. The sooner she got back to civilization, the better. The thought had just registered when the Corolla's engine stopped. It didn't groan or fight or idle. It just turned off, as if she'd turned off the ignition. The car went silent. The power vanished, and she was just rolling on inertia. She pushed the gas pedal and waggled the steering wheel, but it made no difference. She had no brakes, no power steering. 100 yards later, the Corolla rounded a curve and came to a halt on the shoulder. "No, no, no," she muttered. "Not here, not now." But no matter how many times she turned the key, the car did not revive. The radio crackled on for a moment, spewing static and scrambled pop songs, and then died completely. So did her headlights. Tamika sat in the sudden silent dark, flipping switches, turning dials, muttering pleas and prayers. But nothing happened. It was as if the car was no more than a piece of furniture. She was stuck. Reaching behind her, she manually locked all the doors, then fumbled under the passenger seat for a flashlight. But before she turned it on, her eyes locked onto her rearview mirror. If that car were to reappear, rolling up behind her with its lights off, she was dead. Hell, parked where she was, she wouldn't need anyone to have a particularly sinister intent. They could come round the corner and plow right into her before they knew she was there. But no one came. That was almost worse. She was going to have to get out of the car and walk, and hope someone came. The right someone. It felt like a gamble, because it was. Under other circumstances, perhaps if she lived through it all, and could retell the story back home one day, it would be funny. This tale of a New York City girl lost in the Pennsylvania woods at night. She unlatched her door and put her shoulder to it. And in that instant, the darkness was torn asunder by a brilliant blue-white glare that seemed to come from all around. A light so bright that Tamika hid her head in her hands. The car's lights and radio both flickered back into life for a second, then went out. But the light outside, the light that painted the trees impossibly green and white, so that they seemed to leap close and hard, packing in around the car, stayed constant. She squeezed her eyes shut, her head down. 1 second. 2. She opened her eyes again, and the world was rational again. Normal. The light was gone, and she was alone in Dion's crap box car, marooned in the Pennsylvania woods.
What the hell?
She hadn't imagined the light. Could it have been someone's high beams weirdly bouncing off her mirrors? The sky-slashing searchlights of some car dealership display, just the other side of the trees. She pushed the car door wide and slid out, registering a strange silence, as if the world had been muted. As she did so, she snagged the bridge officer's coat on the seatbelt, and as she tugged herself free, watched as a brass button popped off and fell to the road, except that it didn't land. It hovered in the air 18 inches above the ground, spinning. Tamika froze mid-stoop, staring at it. She moved one hand through the air above the suspended button, as if it might be snagged on some invisible thread. Nothing. And then she felt it. A strange pool of darkness, like the shadow of something directly above her. Something vast. Slowly, reluctantly, she tore her eyes off the spinning button and looked directly up into the blackness of the sky. And then the Pennsylvania night tore open again, blasting her sight with the lightning glare of 1,000 bursting stars. 37. Jersey, Argentina, October 1946. One moment, the moonless sky was clear and still, and the next, it was a mere backdrop to the one star that was in motion. I'd seen shooting stars in the mountains in Poland, and I knew immediately that this was not one of them. It seemed to drift sideways, and then, as my attention fixed on it, it pulsed with a swelling brighter light that doubled its overall size before shooting across the sky, flashing once more, and vanishing from sight. I got to my feet, staring open-mouthed, trying to make sense of what I had seen, heart racing, muttering to myself in excited Polish. I was so fixated on the sky that I did not notice that I was no longer alone.
Jersey?
It was Hartsfeld.
Did you see that?
I asked in a breathless whisper.
See what? A star, or a plane, something. It came from over there, and then streaked that way.
A meteor, perhaps? Said Hartsfeld.
No, I said. It changed speeds, maybe direction, too, and it got brighter.
I think you're half asleep, he said, with a little smile. You should get some rest. Long day tomorrow.
No, I said. I really saw it. Maybe if we wait, we'll see another.
Sleep time, seaman, said Hartsfeld, still smiling. That's an order. I scowled, then nodded.
Are the others asleep? I asked, trying to sound casual.
The diplomat gave me a curious look, removing his glasses, and he seemed to read my concern about Belasco. Does that matter? He asked, and there was something hard in his face. No, sir, I said. Good night. He just watched me, saying nothing, and I had the distinct impression that he didn't like me, though I didn't think I had given him any cause. I crawled into the tent, careful to make no noise or brush up against the other sleeping bags. In the dark, I wasn't sure which one was Belasco and which was Ignacio, so I unrolled my bag with the delicacy of defusing a bomb and slid inside. Only when I was secure on my side, huddled into a defensive curl with the sleeping bag pulled up around my head, did I permit myself to replay what I had seen in the sky. I fell asleep thinking about it, managing to forget Belasco and the other dangers of our mission until morning. I said nothing about what I had seen the night before, as we ate our furtive little breakfasts and reloaded the jeep. Belasco must have gotten a hold of a bottle of spirits somewhere. The tent smelled of his acrid breath, and he was surly all morning, shouldering me aside as he climbed aboard. It was warmer than it had been, and the further north we drove, the hotter it became. The road turned to a pitted track, overgrown with potholes deep enough to drown a goat, and the trees crowded in, until we were covered by a towering canopy. It still wasn't the jungle of King Solomon's mines, but it was close, heavy with humidity and the cries of strange wild things. Once a troop of peculiar long-nosed ring-tailed creatures, the size of large house cats, came out onto the path in front of us, and when we stopped, crowded around the jeep, peering in with bright eyes, holding their sides with paws more like hands than any non-human creature I had ever seen. Ignacio called them coati. Belasco gave them a blank stare and shooed them roughly away. "Let's just get wherever the hell we're going," he muttered, closing his eyes and trying to sleep. We were getting close. Hartsfeld studied the map and twice ordered that we stop so he could listen for water. Eventually he consulted his compass and directed us off the main road, such as it was, and onto a still smaller path that crawled deeper into the forest to the northwest, in a region he referred to as Corrientes. "There should be a village up here," he said. "We will ask there." I was forcefully struck by the strangeness of our mission, its seeming randomness. We had not been told how much Hartsfeld knew, or suspected, about the location of Kamler and the other Nazi officers. The idea that we were now going to start questioning whoever we found living in these remote woods seemed bizarre in the extreme. "Is that not risky?" I said, "asking local people who may have been paid off already by the men we are looking for." "I think I can manage, thank you, Seaman," said Hartsfeld, not looking up from his map. "If I've learned anything in the foreign services, dealing with these people, it's hard to get what I want, without actually asking for it." His use of the phrase, "these people," bothered me, and not only because I doubted the people he dealt with in the offices of Buenos Aires were the same as the ones up here in the rainforest, but it was also the kind of phrase the Nazis had used about people like me. I shaded my eyes from the glare and watched an unreasonably iridescent bird with long trailing tail feathers. Soon, I was using my hands to protect my face and arms from the great leaves pressing in on the car, and swatting at the constant buzz of insects around my head. "This," said Belasco, confidingly, "is bullshit." Something in his irritated grumpiness amused me, and for once I actually laughed so that he, surprised, grinned back, as if we were friends, united in misery. We found the village, or a village, as we pushed deeper into the forest, but our first attempts to get information from the locals met with an unexpected snag. The woman we found grinding maize, her children gathered around her on the dirt floor of her open house, did not speak Spanish. The other three jabbered away at her, but got nothing useful in return. "Guarani," Ignacio pronounced with casual scorn. "Tupi." Belasco demanded something of Ignacio, presumably whether he knew any words of these other languages, but the Argentine shook his head emphatically, and then a flicker of amusement at his employer's stupidity. Hartsfeld scowled, then gave him another slew of instructions, whereupon the boy set the vehicle in motion again. Twice more we stopped to talk to the natives, but made no headway, so that eventually we drove on, hoping for better luck at the next settlement we found. We were rewarded on the shores of a long, sparkling lake, where, for a few coins, a Spanish-speaking fisherman agreed to serve as interpreter with the locals in the village. So we drove back, hot and irritable now, but at least with a sense of progress made. It was hard going, and I saw a lot of head-shaking and blank looks. What I didn't see, however, was deception. These people just didn't know anything about the men we were looking for. They did, however, verify where we were, and when we got back into the car, Hartsfeld looked pleased. 8 miles north of here, he said. We'll get more information there.
And when we find them? Asked Belasco. What do we do then? Take down the map coordinates and drive back to Buenos Aires? What is the point, if you already know where they are?
We don't, said Hartsfeld, not turning round. Not precisely. We need a good fix on where they are, and how many of them there are, and what they have with them.
So we can do what? Belasco pressed. Drop the U.S. airborne on them? Bomb the shit out of the whole area?
That's not your concern, said Hartsfeld, haughtily. If we're going to restart the Second World War in the goddamn jungles of Argentina, I'd like to know about it, Belasco shot back.
Just follow your orders, said Hartsfeld, and we'll have no problems.
Belasco said nothing. But I couldn't help worrying just how far Hartsfeld's authority would stretch out here in the jungle. We came upon the next village that afternoon. Despite offers of more money, our fisherman translator had refused to come with us. So we were faced once more with the prospect of trying to make ourselves understood. We found a Spanish speaker on our second attempt. Half the village gathered to hear what was going on. And there was a lot of arguing and pointing off into the forest, as Hartsfeld probed them. Again, I saw no signs that anyone was keeping anything secret. And it struck me that the Nazis would want as few dealings as possible with people such as these. At last, Hartsfeld seemed satisfied. White people were seen going in this direction 2 weeks ago, he said, pointing along a trail far too narrow for a jeep.
2 weeks? Belasco scoffed. They could be anywhere by now.
Hartsfeld shook his head. That was only the most recent group, he said. Apparently, they've been coming here for several years, bringing things with them. The boys in the village have been out to where they went, and say there is something there. Something we are going to want to see. I think, gentlemen, that we found what we came for. We unloaded the car where it stood, opening up the equipment crates, but leaving the tent and all but a little of the food and water. We would carry no more than we needed, and, if possible, would be back within a few hours. The crate included a .45-caliber Thompson submachine gun and an M1 Garand. Belasco took the sub, so I got the rifle, a weapon I hadn't fired since boot camp.
Not to be used unless absolutely necessary, said Hartsfeld, eyeing Belasco significantly. This is a recon mission only. You shoot to keep yourself alive. That's all.
Belasco gave me an unreadable look. He didn't like Nazis. I didn't either. But for all his machismo and swagger, I don't think he knew what it was like to kill one. I did.
Keep the flashlights off unless absolutely necessary, said Hartsfeld, as we began our trek along the path.
For now, we didn't need them. But after an hour's hike, the sun was almost down, and the jungle was giving itself over to a deep green darkness. Ignacio eyed the rifle slung across my back, warily. I didn't know why he was still with us, instead of waiting at the car. But Hartsfeld had insisted.
Wouldn't want to walk into the jungle and vanish without trace, he remarked to me.
I scowled, but nodded. It made about as much sense as the rest of this mission. Night came on fast in the rainforest. Howler monkeys screamed in the treetops, and strange birds, with heavy-looking beaks as long as their bodies, flew off to their roosts. For all I knew, we were watched by jaguars, though I saw no sign of them. What we saw instead was far stranger and more unexpected. At first I thought it was a house, looming out of the darkness of the trees. But then I realized it was far larger than any house, and of a completely different style of construction than anything we had seen in the last few days. It was more like the curtain wall of a stone castle, with high shuttered windows that leaked light, and a great barred door set in a heavy arch, and it was no more native to these steamy woods than I was. In fact, the building was so unlike the jungle around it, that the whole felt more than imposing. It felt dreamlike, as if the structure had been picked up from somewhere else and dropped here.
"What the hell?" breathed Belasco, dropping into a crouch.
I moved to the other side of the path, unslinging the rifle and bringing its muzzle to bear on the uncanny door. Ignacio hung back, looking suddenly very unsure of himself. Hartsfeld, however, just smiled. "Cover me," he said to Belasco, reaching inside his sweat-stained jacket as he approached the door. Hartsfeld moved casually, walking upright, no trace of caution in his gait, no attempt to make himself small in case gunfire erupted from one of those upper windows. It felt wrong. As Belasco edged out towards him, I found myself almost overwhelmed by the urge to call him back. Hartsfeld reached the door, and I realized what he had drawn from his pocket. It was a key. I didn't see it, not at first, but I heard the snap of a lock and the creak of the door. And suddenly, the darkness of the jungle was lit by a soft, yellowish glow from within. Hartsfeld spoke, and it took me a moment to process the significance of what he had said. The words, "I'm here, but I have brought guests," were less important, perhaps, than the fact that he said them in German.
"Ich bin hier, aber ich habe die Gast gebracht."
And now I did call to Belasco. But Hartsfeld was already turning, pocketing the key, and drawing a black automatic pistol. He aimed it squarely at Belasco, who, finally realizing what was happening, pointed the submachine gun at the diplomat in the doorway and squeezed the trigger. There was a click, but nothing else happened. And silhouetted in the unearthly arch, and with his Nazi comrades at his back, Hartsfeld gave a little grunt that was almost a laugh.
"I'm afraid I took the liberty of removing the firing pins from your weapons last night," he said.
And then he started shooting. 38. Barney and Betty Hill. White Mountains, New Hampshire. September 1961. It had been a long trip, and there were still several hours to go before they reached Portsmouth. But the New Hampshire roads were quiet, and the night was clear. Barney Hill checked his side-view mirrors and shifted in the driver's seat, feeling the weight of the pistol in his pocket. It would normally stay in the trunk, but they had picnicked near Twin Mountain, and Betty was afraid of bears. Niagara had been something to see. The height, the sheer volume of water crashing down the cliff face. Just amazing, and alone worth the drive, even though the air pollution made it hard to see. The picnic at Twin Mountain had been his idea. He hadn't said as much to Betty, but he was tired of the sidelong looks in the diners, the probing mixtures of curiosity and shock, gazes turned quickly away when he looked around. Betty didn't seem to notice, though he wondered if that was a choice, a blind spot she had developed to get through the day. Every day, Barney was reminded that it was still unusual to see a black man with a white wife. But it wore on him like the teeth of a saw rasped along barbed wire. And that was just the polite folk, the ones who averted their eyes or forced a smile, as if nothing were wrong. But there were others, the ones who stared, or waited for you to look at them before spitting pointedly on the ground. Sometimes it was worse. Betty ignored it, but the revolver in his pocket was there to keep more than bears away. And it was no accident that their vacations took them north, not south. Patsy Cline was crooning "I Fall to Pieces" on the radio, turned down so low that Barney could barely hear it, and then Bobby V singing "Take Good Care of My Baby." Chicago White Sox second baseman Nellie Fox had driven in 2 runs to beat the Red Sox 5-1 earlier that day, the news said. Barney turned to his wife to see if she was sleeping and, as she smiled drowsily at him, took her hand for a moment.
"Watch the road, lover boy," she said in her flat New England voice, grinning before turning to the dark wooded hills outside.
"Just a couple more hours now," he said. "You can sleep if you want."
"Okay," she said. She sounded vague, as if she were already drifting off. In her lap, Delcy, their overindulged pet dachshund, shifted and looked up, tongue lolling and eyes hopeful. Barney wanted to get a few more miles under their belts before stopping to let the dog out, but she was clearly getting restless. He settled back, turning the big Chevy's steering wheel with a firm but easy grip as he angled it round the winding country road. It was a good car, a classic already, the kind that never went out of style and, with a little loving care, would run forever. They passed through Lancaster, following Route 3 south towards White Mountain National Forest, with Mount Washington looming on their left. It was a region infamous for erratic weather and lost hikers. Over 100 fatalities, it was said, and Barney was glad that they were making the trip now, before the cold weather set in. He checked the Bel Air's gas gauge. The last thing he wanted was to get stranded up here. He didn't think they'd be in any real danger, but his buddies at the post office, who'd been calling him the Fearless Explorer ever since he'd told them about the trip north of the border, would never let him live it down. He grinned at the thought.
"What's that?"
Betty was, apparently, still awake.
"What's what?"
he said.
"Over there," she said.
She popped the glove compartment open and pulled out the field glasses they had used to look at the waterfall earlier.
"Slow down," she said. "I can't see it."
"See what?" he said, easing off on the gas.
"Up there," said Betty. "Look, there's a light. See? Just to the side of the moon. It's moving."
"I don't see it."
"Right there. Look. It's getting brighter."
"Shooting star, maybe."
"It's going up."
"Plane, then."
"Pull over," said Betty. "I want to use the binoculars."
"Oh, come on, Betty," Barney replied. "We still have a ways to go."
"Going to have to let Delcy out soon," said Betty. "May as well be now."
Barney sighed and shot the dog a sour look. "Fine," he said, turning the wheel and applying the brakes. He wasn't sure why they'd brought the damn dog in the first place. It wasn't like she needed to see the sights. They could have kenneled her for a night or two. Wouldn't have been the end of the world, but Betty wouldn't hear of it.
"Part of the family," she'd said.
Barney rolled his eyes, but he smiled at the same time. People didn't get them, but he loved his wife very much. After all the looks they got, he had never doubted, for one moment, that marrying her had been the right thing to do. While Betty fussed with the binoculars, he watched the dog do its business on the grass shoulder, inhaling the cool of the forest air, and listening to the chirp of insects, and thanking God it wasn't black fly season. He had turned the headlights off, and the mountains and trees were dark to the point of blackness.
"It's crossing in front of the moon," said Betty, tracking with her binoculars. "It has lights on it."
"Probably a jetliner headed to Montreal," said Barney.
"It's not the right shape. Look."
She handed him the binoculars. At first he couldn't find it. There was nothing to focus on. But when he saw the light tracking northwest with his naked eye, he was able to home in with the field glasses. "Plane," he said, peering at the lighted craft as it angled steadily up the way they had come.
"Gotta be."
And then, without warning, it changed direction. A sharp turn and hard descent. A move unlike any plane he had ever seen before. He lowered the binoculars so he could find the craft again and tried to refocus on it, but it was moving too quickly.
"It's coming right for us," he said, baffled.
For a moment, the two of them watched, their disinterested dog snuffling at their feet. And then Barney felt a slow but rising unease that he could not explain.
"Pick up Delcy," he said. "Get back in the car."
Biddy gave him a quizzical look, but she didn't hesitate, and he knew she could feel it too. A muffled and unspecific urgency, just this side of alarm. But once they were back in the car, headlights on, moving toward Franconia Notch, the feeling turned into a kind of childish excitement. Betty had heard talk of flying saucers from her sister, and the idea that they might have seen one was exhilarating. Barney wasn't so sure, but he had to admit that the way the craft had moved was about the damnedest thing he had ever seen. It took a moment to realize it was still there, and that it seemed to have descended, and if he were a fanciful kind of guy, which he wasn't, Barney would have sworn it was following them. It had been heading north before. Not anymore. Now it was slipping south, lower and lower in the sky, so that from time to time it would be screened out entirely by the craggy landscape of mountains and tall pines that lined the road. As they passed Cannon Mountain, the object seemed to scud through the air only a couple of hundred yards above them. It was now clearly not a plane. It had no wings, and resembled the flattened yo-yo with lights along the edge, which seemed to be rotating. It was also big. When it passed the great granite outcrop, known locally as the Old Man of the Mountain, because of how it looked in profile, like a head sticking out of the cliff, eyes, mouth, forehead and chin all quite visible, Barney finally got a sense of scale. The thing must have been close to 60 feet across. It was also, as far as he could tell over the noise of the car engine, completely silent, moving in looping bounds, little surges of acceleration that took it up and down, weaving effortlessly from side to side. So that in spite of the dread he'd felt before, Barney couldn't help sensing something playful in the aircraft's pursuit. He wondered about that word. Was it really pursuing them? Tracking them, certainly. Watching. Maybe they should find some place where they could call the police, or the Air Force. But Barney didn't like showing up in places he wasn't expected. Not at night. A black man with a white woman in the American backcountry. He'd wait until they saw familiar faces. And maybe even then? Barney knew how to fight from his corner. As a leading member of the Portsmouth NAACP, he was proud of who he was. But he had also learned to pick his battles. He knew that white people looked for a reason not to take him seriously. Telling the world he'd spent the evening playing hide-and-seek with a flying saucer was as good as dressing up as Uncle Remus and sitting on the porch with a haystack between his teeth. The disc slid into the night behind them and vanished. Then, a mile south of Indian Head, it returned, in front of them now, and lower than ever, so that it seemed to sit motionless above the road directly ahead. Barney slowed the Bel Air to a crawl, and eventually came to a halt. The saucer hovered in front of them, no more than 80 feet in the air. Barney, his earlier apprehension returning tenfold, were sure that he did not want to drive the car under the craft. "Stay here," he said. He reached over and took the binoculars from his wife's lap. "What are you doing?" asked Betty. "Just wait here," he said, checking the pistol in his pocket, shouldering the door open, and stepping out onto the road.
"Bonnie, you get back in here,"
said Betty, her voice shrill with fear.
"One second," he said.
He walked up the road, slowly, bathed in the hard white light from the craft in front of him. As he got closer, he found that it seemed to be angled down toward him, and at its rim, he could see windows tilted at the road. At him. As he stepped inside the glare, he could make out shapes at the windows, figures, and what he took to be black uniforms. His sense was that they were human-like, but not human. He raised the binoculars to see better, but as he did so, the object seemed to change. Structures descended smoothly from the sides and underbelly, things that might have been legs,
and some kind of access chute. Barney turned quickly back to the car, suddenly sure that they had to get out of there. Now. He dragged the Bel Air's door open and fell into the driver's seat, hands trembling as he turned the ignition key.
"They're going to take us," he babbled. "They're trying to capture us."
"God!"
Betty exclaimed.
"Watch for them,"
Barney commanded as he gunned the engine.
"It's moving!"
The legs, or whatever they had been, retracted again. The ship moved directly overhead. For a moment, the car was full of its strange, hard light. Betty was crying. Delcy was whimpering. Barney floored the accelerator, sending them rocketing away down the road as fast as he dared go.
"Are they still behind us?"
he asked. Betty wound down her window and leaned out, craning her neck and looking all around.
"I don't see it," she shouted into the wind. "I don't see anything."
But then the noise started, a strange rhythmic plinking that seemed to come from the Bel Air's trunk. The car seemed to hum with energy. Barney touched the metal of the door gingerly, expecting to feel the bite of static electricity, but got only a dull vibration, quite separate from what the Bel Air's engine was doing. Almost immediately, the long drive, and all the mental focus required to operate the car through hundreds of miles of empty road, seemed to weigh on him. His eyelids drooped, his head lolled, and he felt the leaden pressure of sleep swallow him. He came to with a start. He blinked and shifted deliberately. That had been close. Falling asleep at the wheel had always been one of his greatest fears. Out here in the woods, that could only end badly. He felt Betty stir beside him and saw she was waking up from a nap, too. There had been something they had been talking about, but he couldn't remember what it was. And that meant he really had fallen asleep, which was terrifying. Maybe he should get a cup of coffee somewhere. He checked his watch, but it had stopped. And that was weird, because he knew he had wound it that morning.
"What time is it?"
he asked.
It's, oh, damn.
"What?"
"Looks like my watch stopped,"
Betty answered.
"Where are we?"
"Indian Head, right?" said Barney, less sure than he would have liked. Betty paused.
"That sign said Tilton," she said.
"Can't be," said Barney.
"That's over 30 miles away. We haven't gone through Plymouth yet."
But the town that they drove through was indeed Tilton.
"That's not possible," said Barney. "I can't have been that tired and not wrecked the car. You remember going through Plymouth?"
Betty shook her head. She looked rattled.
"I don't remember anything since..."
She reached into her memory, then shook her head.
"I don't know. Something. There was a light in the sky."
"We stopped," said Barney, dragging the memory back to the surface, as if he were reeling in some strange fish, dark and nightmarish, from the deep sea.
"We set off again," said Betty. "But there was another light. A roadblock."
Barney nodded, his skin starting to creep, the hair on his neck rising.
"This isn't right," he said. "Let's stop. I need to get gas and a cup of coffee."
"And a shower," said Betty. It was a bizarre thing to say, and she laughed, but it turned into a gasp, almost a sob, and there was something haunted in her eyes.
"Yes," said Barney, sensing it too. "A shower. Yes."
He felt unclean. He couldn't explain it. It was as if something had happened that he could not recall. Something had been done to him.
"My dress," said Betty.
Her voice was at once absent and fearful.
"It's torn. When did that happen?"
Barney looked at her, fingering the ragged hem of her dress. And he felt it again, that there was something just out of reach of his memory. He glanced down. His carefully polished shoes were scuffed and dirty.
What the hell?
They stopped at the first all-night gas station they could find, and both went inside to use the restroom, to wash, no, to scrub, as much of their bodies as they could. They didn't know why. It was while they were paying for the gas that Betty tried to set her watch to the clock above the register. The watch wouldn't restart. Neither would Barney's. But that was nothing compared to the shock of discovering that it was almost dawn. They had lost nearly 3 hours. What had happened in that time was a dark, narrow hole in their memories. No matter how hard they stared into it, they could not see the bottom. 39. Alan, Dreamland, Nevada.
What the hell were you thinking? Hatcher demanded. First tourist flights to Stonehenge, now this? When you are on a mission with Marat, he is your commanding officer, and you do as he tells you. You do not go chasing imaginary lights across the sky on a whim.
Wasn't imaginary, said Alan. Or a whim.
Did I ask you to speak, Major? Then shut up.
Alan did not reply.
Your instruments show no record of any other craft, Hatcher continued, his voice lower, but his eyes as hard and level as ever. Things are different up there.